Welcome to the Banana Split Project, a podcast collecting stories of Western Asians, overseas Asians, or so-called bananas coming back to live in Asia. My name is Vivian. I myself am a banana. I'm French. I was born in France, but my parents are from Asia. My mom is from Hong Kong and my dad is Chinese from Indonesia. So I have Asian heritage, but I feel very Western, very French inside. I now live in Singapore, where I moved in 2006 with my husband. Since I arrived 14 years ago, I've experienced many moments when I realized that although I feel very French and I do sound very French, people don't see me that way. What they expect from me isn't what they really get. For instance, they would believe I'm a local, I'm an Indonesian or Vietnamese or Thai, but when I open my mouth, they realize I'm not. So it's very confusing, and it's very confusing for me too. And I started to talk about that with many people like me, mainly French people from Asian heritage too. And that's how I started the podcast. So basically, the podcast is about Western Asian history and identity. And I want to explore the story of our parents who came to Europe, America and Australia from Asia. Why are we, a generation later, coming back to Asia? What are we doing here? Are we following our own path or maybe looking for our roots? This podcast is my way of trying to understand who we really are, what is our history, what is our own story, and what is our new culture that we are building. Trying to bridge a gap between our past, when our ancestors left Asia and went to the West, to the future, which is mainly Asian. We are all here in Asia now, this generation. So far, I've interviewed only French people. I already have 8 episodes, and this is my 9th episode, and the first one in English. So I'm very happy today to have with me Will Phan, an Australian guy who is from Chinese and Vietnamese heritage, and who came to Singapore about 5 years ago. We met in our co-working space. He's the CEO of New Campus that he founded. So welcome, Will.
Thanks. Hello, Will.
Hi, thanks, Vivian. Thanks for having me.
Cool. So tell me a bit more about your story, your family history. When and how did they move to Australia?
Yes, that's really good timing because we bumped into each other walking at the co-working space the other day. And I've actually been working on designing a family tree for my mother's side over the past couple of weeks because A, it was a bit of a sort of side project, and B, I personally wanted to find more about, you know, what happened during my mother's experience throughout the Vietnamese War. Mm. So just a bit of context, my father's from Macau, Hong Kong, and my mom is from Vietnam, but she's born from Chinese heritage, and they both immigrated to Sydney and then had myself, my older sister, my younger brother. So I kind of have a bit of a mix of Chinese, Vietnamese blood. So, and I do think that this was a really interesting period where you had people from Hong Kong migrate for studies and people from Vietnam migrate because during the Vietnam War.
So you were born in Australia, in Sydney?
Yes, so I was born in the 80s in a small city called Bankstown. That area had a lot of immigrants, most of which were Vietnamese and Lebanese. So it was really fascinating, even though we spoke different languages, looked very different. The cultural values were very similar.
What kind of values? Immigrants' values? Immigrants related, like a resilience, I guess? And or what was the focus on at home in your family?
Yeah, I think, if you look at the Chinese-Vietnamese migration, you're either more skewed towards Chinese values or more skewed to Vietnamese values. Mm-hmm. And I think what was quite interesting was, and just doing this research project myself, was some families would marry more into Vietnamese when they arrived, and some would marry more into Chinese, which was more my family. So when I grew up, I actually had two cultural upbringing. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I would spend time with my paternal grandparents, which were more Chinese and Cantonese. So I was brought up speaking Cantonese. Mm-hmm. But then when I'd visit my mum's side, they would be speaking a mix of Mandarin, Vietnamese, Cantonese. So I think from my mum's side, which was coming from the war, you do hear a lot of stories around hustle, around lost family members. Mm-hmm. And even the food was very different. Mm-hmm. So you would have, you know, Vietnamese buns and, you know, Vietnamese noodles, whereas Cantonese side, you eat Canton food.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So food is different. Values are similar, but still a bit different. Language is very different. So you were brought up in how many different languages?
So my mom actually spoke five languages growing up.
Okay.
She actually spoke a bit of French, Vietnamese, Mandarin, Cantonese, and obviously English, because she did study those languages at school. And for my father, was born and raised speaking Cantonese from Hong Kong.
So were you very conscious of your heritage while growing up? Because you were in a mixed environment, so were you aware of what kind of a cultural heritage you were in?
I think we got a lot of exposure. And when you talk about cultural heritage, you'd be looking at things like religion. You'll be looking at things like communities that you spend time with. Even when I was growing up, I went to, you know, in primary school, you go to, you know, very Western school. So there weren't that many Asians. So in a class of 15, I was one out of two Asians. But then I went to a high school, which was predominantly Asians, Vietnamese, Korean, Chinese, and Indians.
Oh, okay.
So even that whole paradigm shift was quite unique, because you suddenly, you don't become the minority, but you're kind of the majority. And then going to university, you know, majority of the people at my university were Asian background. So it almost became this realization as you grow, you know, you're not just the immigration, you're kind of part of the majority of the ecosystem. And so even if you go back to Sydney or Melbourne now, if you walk down the main streets, you'll realize a lot of the ads, the billboards, the people are of Asian background. So I think it's just been really interesting being part of that story.
So in a way, it became kind of mainstream being an Asian guy in your city.
And you hear stories the same thing. You go to San Francisco, you go to Paris. Originally, it would have been the Chinatown where all the Asians, immigrants gathered, for example. And then they would sort of move into their own smaller cities, or they'd move out towards the West and, you know, start their own communities there. But in Australia now, I would say that it's almost strange going back how Asian it is. So when I came to Singapore, it didn't feel like a significant change. If anything, it just, you know, felt like it was only a stepping out. Yeah, very seamless move abroad.
Cool. I'm curious because I heard a lot of stories about discrimination in Australia against Asian people. So is that true? Did you experience that?
Of course. I mean, Australia is very well known for being casually racist, and that can come in a lot of different forms, whether it's conversation or through, you know, just casual interactions, especially in, you know, where I was brought up, where you have a lot of immigrants moving forward, moving through like the Lebanese, then the Vietnamese, Chinese, and now even the Middle Eastern immigrants. It's, you always see this, again, like there's no other phrase, but it's just a very casually racist city. And when you're growing up, you don't understand, you know, when someone says something,
you don't realize
realize what it means. And even like moving into a very Asian school, you're always questioning, okay, if you know, go north or go west, like where are those, you know, different cultural backgrounds living and working and operating out of? Because at the end of the day, you can actually look at it in a few different ways, from religion to working culture to, you know, just, you know, going to afternoon school over the weekends, like what type of people go there. So I think I thought it was really we definitely experienced a lot of racism growing up, and I still think, you know, Australia hasn't really shifted.
Although you were in a majority Asian school, but so were there racism against, I mean, amongst Asians, like between different ethnics? So I'm quite surprised, because some people say when you grow up in a community that is closely knit, like an Asian community, so you wouldn't feel that because you're part of the mainstream. But that's outside, you mean outside of your school, right? Not within.
I think even that, you have such strong cultural values with Koreans and Indians and Chinese, for example. So you definitely knew that, you know, growing up in your first years of high school, you'd have, you know, those kids hanging around each other. Granted, I think we went to a pretty forward-thinking multicultural school. But, I mean, on the other spectrum, you'll have, you know, a few members on my team went to schools that were majority white folks, and they were, you know, 5% of the, you know, school cohort were Asian. So he definitely, and she definitely got a lot of impact in terms of, you know, being told, you know, nasty things growing up. But for me, I think it was almost a pride that, you know, you're part of a small community. And then when you see other people that share the same skin tone or eat similar strange Asian food, you suddenly, you don't feel as ashamed. And I think that's something that you grow up, intrinsically thinking, but then, yeah, it wasn't easy.
So how well does it balance, actually, that your Asian part, your cultural Asian part, and your Australian side, your Australian identity?
Yeah, so, I mean, this podcast is called The Banana Split, right? Mm-hmm. And the context, like, the term banana is your yellow skin, but then a white inside. Mm-hmm. And I was actually thinking about that whole concept or that analogy on the way to work today, because I do think as I've, you know, been more exposed to the Asia region and working in Asia, I wouldn't call myself banana. I'd be more like an Asian fruit, you know, an Australian country. And I think that's because, you know, growing up, I did share a lot of like values with the Chinese community. So even now, when I go back, I feel like a foreigner again. When I think about growing up as an Aussie, you do have your Australian side, which is the food, the drinks, the cultural banter that you have. But, you know, I also grew up seeing my grandparents every weekend for dinner, taking my shoes off when I go into home, you know, making sure that I'm, you know, studying hard and, you know, getting a good job, as, you know, immigrant parents would want to invest in their kid to do so. So I do think that even though my accent is Australian, I probably hold more Asian values than more people than not.
So you said that it was not a big shock coming to Singapore because you are already very familiar with those Chinese roots and with these Asian values. So for you, it wasn't such a big gap, right?
Yeah, and I can definitely say I'm probably more exposed to Asia than a lot of my friends back in Australia. This could be because I traveled a lot more when I was a kid. Maybe once a year I'd go to Hong Kong or I'd, you know, do high school trips to Japan and Korea with my friends and school. So I got a lot more exposure to Asian culture and that kind of drew me in. But when I think about like coming to Singapore, it was more of a business opportunity versus finding
looking
my roots.
For your roots, yeah.
But when I'm in Asia, it's, you know, you realize Asia is just so in tune with what you grew up with. Maybe they speak different languages or their skin is slightly darker tone or lighter tone, but at the end of the day, they share very, like, a lot more cultural values than you are to you, which is the reason why I'm still here.
And how do you think people perceive you here, like locals, Singaporean, how do they perceive you, or other expats, or do you have a feeling of belonging, or do you feel sometimes like a foreigner here? Or?
Yeah, so I mean, if you asked me this question 5 years ago, I'd had a very different answer. When we first came, by we, I mean my co-founder and I, we did feel like the Aussies in flip-flops and shorts, and we did feel like outsiders. But 5 years later, it's home to us. And I feel more at home getting out of the airport and coming back home versus, you know, going to see my parents or grandparents in Sydney. And I think I'm part of this sort of third culture generation where your home is where, you know, what you make of it. And so, you know, apart from being in Singapore, I actually spent quite a bit of time in the Middle East, in Dubai, and a bit of time in Shanghai, China. So I think, you know, I've actually spent more of my adult years abroad than in Sydney. So I do think that, again, I've built a much stronger network of friends and partners and my team in Asia, which is what is the rock that keeps me home, essentially.
Asia.
Yeah.
And as you said, as a third culture kid, you make up your own identity and you absorb a little bit of everything, right? And it becomes your own and it's very unique flavor.
Yeah, and I think that's a growing trend now. I was just speaking with another Korean British entrepreneur, you know, and she was talking about how a lot of Koreans that study abroad can't integrate back when they go to Seoul because of potential bastardized language or even, you know, just cultural nuances and cultural values. So when I talk about the bastardized language, you know, my parents taught me Cantonese and Mandarin that they learned 20 years ago. So even if I go back to China or go back to, you know, Hong Kong, the way that they speak is completely different. Their vocabulary is a lot more advanced and the way that I talk is very broken. So, I mean, I do feel as though there's a gap in terms of, you know, all these Asian Westerners or third culture kids and even third culture companies that are looking to find their calling.
And what's your relationship with Vietnam as a country? Because most of the time, we have a lot of French Vietnamese in France, and I've talked to a lot of them, and some experience some trauma and difficulty to go back there because of their history. Or for some, they don't know anything. It's like a taboo. So I was wondering.
Yeah, well, it's not just a taboo. It's just a very heartbreaking experience for their family and their parents and their grandparents' generation. And if you asked me this 2 weeks ago, I would have an answer for you because, you know, up until then, I had heard a lot of hearsay stories from, you know, my cousins and my uncles and my aunties. But as I mentioned at the start, I actually started working on designing a family tree for my Chinese Vietnamese side of the family. And what we realized was my grandparents actually were born and raised in Guangdong, China, and they moved to a small city in Chau Dok on the border of Vietnam and Cambodia, which is where they set up their first business. And then their family, so five siblings, including my grandfather, moved to Ho Chi Minh. And then during the Vietnam War, that's when they dispersed. So one of their siblings, my grandfather's sister, went to Toronto. The other went to San Francisco. The other went to Hong Kong. And the other two went to Sydney. My grandfather actually got lost in the war. So my mom was part of a, you know, group of cousins that moved from Vietnam to China and from China to Hong Kong and then Hong Kong to Sydney.
Wow.
So even mapping up that story, and she's part of a cousin group of about 30, and my second cousin group of my age right now is around 50 cousins. So bringing all of them together, who are now scattered across the US and Australia and Vietnam and Hong Kong, has been a really immersive and enriching exercise. But just mapping out, you know, the routes that they took to escape the war via boat or plane or via foot, it's just been, you know, a crazy experience.
Classic diaspora history. And do you know how your mom escaped? Was it by plane, by boat, or did she have to transit through Thailand? Or?
So I think, well, my mom has been really helpful because she's probably the only one of the few aunties in that generation that can speak English and Chinese well. So I actually can get along, you know, really well. But my cousins do have language barriers with their parents. And even when you translate it, it might be very broken down. So we actually sat down and did an exercise, and her escape route was taking a train, or she paid, you know, her mom paid $6 for her to take a truck to Ho Chi Minh from Chau Dok. And then she escaped through a train to Guangzhou in China. And that's where she was picked up by one of the grandparents. And then she stayed there for a couple of months. And then she, you know, took a plane to Hong Kong, and then she immigrated from Hong Kong to Sydney. And, you know, her other seven siblings at that time kind of did the same thing, but in their own way. So I think three of them took a boat, two of them got lost in the war. So they became MIA and the other two stayed, the other one stayed in Vietnam. So, you know, just even realizing that they didn't see each other for 3 to 4 years and then reconnecting in Australia in early 80s. You can't really fathom what that means.
Yeah.
And that's why I think a lot of Vietnamese families or Chinese Vietnamese families don't talk about this.
No, it's a still very traumatic experience, and it's difficult to put words on that. And you mentioned that you are now doing a research project on that. So what triggered this this desire to?
So I recently hired my cousin to join my team. You know, what's quite interesting is we were brought up in the same, you know, cousin circle. We went to university together, and now he's in Seoul with his family. But when he was in Singapore, we were just talking about, you know, why haven't we, you know, documented any of this before? And I think it was because, you know, 5 years ago when we were still at university, you don't dare to ask and you don't really care. But now our generation, we're at the there's a small window where our grandparents are still alive. They're old, albeit their, you know, their mind's a bit fuzzy. Our parents are semi or retired, so they have a bit more time to talk, have conversations. And we're more digitally savvy. So we're able to, you know, connect with our other cousins and write down and use mediums and Twitters and Google Sheets to put together information. And also realizing that the Gen Z that are slightly younger than us completely missed out those conversations. So if anything, our group of immigrants are probably the best people to be documenting these stories.
Yeah, I believe we have such a big role to play, yeah. Right? And I think we are the right age too, because we're out of our studies, we are settled in our yeah. adult life, and it's the right time now to inquire about all this and to figure out where we come from and who we are.
Actually. Yeah, I mean, it's the same reason why you're doing this project
exactly,
now.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah.
Because you have this curiosity and that itch. And I do think it's not just yourself, but you know, the Koreans, the Vietnamese, the Japanese, the, you know, Indians are all experiencing the same thing with having a bit of identity here and there, here nor there, and trying to understand what that actually means.
Mm-hmm. And why do you think this community isn't publicly seen as much as other kind of communities, other kind of immigrants, like in the US or...
So that's a good question, because even in 2019, it was the first time, well, not the first time, but such a big, I guess, momentum shift for the acknowledgement of Asian heritage.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at the history of movie and cinema, where you would have the white person dressed up as the Japanese actor or actress in the 70s, and now you have Crazy Rich Asians, you have that movie with, I forgot her name, about the grandmother in China.
Something about the wedding, the fake wedding.
It's with Awkwafina, and it's basically about this American Chinese woman that goes back to China to look after her dying grandmother.
Yeah.
And it was actually really touching, because you end up looking, there's so many nuances in it that you grow up understanding. And so I do think that you have certain archetypes of Asians being portrayed now in media more than ever. So you do have your Southeast Asians promoted in the Singaporean, families promoted in Crazy Rich Asians. You do have the American Chinese community in food, in beverage, in media. But I do think that there will be an emerging class that become more westernized or more open with opportunities to be westernized. And I think that just comes with time. So even I came across a phrase called Vozies. The Vozzy, which stands
never
for Vietnamese Aussies.
Ah.
So you have American Vietnamese food, which is already mainstream. You have Vietnamese food, which is in Vietnam. And you have Vietnamese Australian food, which is starting to become a bit more of a mainstream.
Oh.
So
what kind of mix is that?
For example, Vietnamese food is actually really well done in Melbourne and Sydney, because the produce is, you know, Australian beef, for example. So having that twist and having that twang, and you suddenly have this new subculture of food. And so, you know, even early next year, I'm thinking about, again, part of a side passion, like launching a Vietnamese Australian food festival.
Nice.
And you have, you know, your pho's, you have your banh mi's, you have your, you know, your local, you know, twist, by local, I mean Australian Vietnamese twist. And I'm sure there's a community that wants that as well.
Yeah, and in Singapore too, a lot of French Vietnamese are always looking for the best pho in town, and
yeah.
It's a big conversation.
Yeah, I think there's only one place in town. if you guys are listening, it's on Joo Chiat Road.
What do you think makes us bananas a community? Do you think we share some values because we are westernized, and especially those who come back in Asia?
I don't know if we have a community yet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, this is the first time we're having this conversation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it just happened because we bumped into each other along the corridor. So we don't necessarily, you know, say, oh, you have an Asian skin, let's, you know, let's talk.
I mean, everyone has Asian skin.
Yeah.
Around here.
But I do think what's been quite interesting being in China was you do feel a sense of expats being in China, being a community driver.
Mm-hmm.
So you would have Spanish, you have Spanish Americans who speak pure, like really, really strong Mandarin, and that brings them together. And it's probably because they are genuinely immersed in the culture, whereas in cities like Hong Kong, Singapore, you do have expats that hang out with expats, and they do expat things like, you know, getting beers and going to the pub and doing that, your yoga, CrossFit, whatnot. I mean, to answer your question, Vivian, I don't know what is going to bring banana cultures together, because we've been brought up trying to fit in for so long.
I know.
So it's almost like a
reverse shift.
And the phrase isn't, it's almost like you reject new people coming in because it's almost like a defensive mechanism. So even now, I've started to open up a lot more and, you know, like having these open conversations mm-hmm. because you do understand we come from very similar stories. We have mm-hmm. very similar values. And I do think doing podcasts like this does raise that conversation mm-hmm. and hopefully brings more people together.
Exactly. That's the aim of it. I want to raise awareness. And because in Singapore, I was surprised to find out that there is a group of about 200 French bananas. We have a WhatsApp group with about 200 of these people. And in France, I wasn't connected with these kind of people. But now I feel that I need to do it. So I was wondering if OSS is like so voices were kind of organizing themselves too into a WhatsApp group, or if there was something, because you have a term now, you have a word, so what do you put behind your word and what do you want to do with that
actually? I would say it's not necessarily Vossies per se, but we mm-hmm. do have Australian Chinese groups.
Okay.
So for example, we do have a WhatsApp group where we hang out with a lot of friends that come over for board games Christmas dinners we even travel together mm-hmm. and it's not just because you went to school or know a friend of a friend, but again, the community is so small. You mm-hmm. have 200, you know, French Asians mm-hmm. in Singapore. That's mm-hmm. not a lot of people.
No, that's the one that are on the group, but they're probably more.
Yeah, exactly. So it's almost like, should you make it more mainstream? That's another question. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I mean, to answer that question, like we do have groups. It's a lot smaller than 200, but it's a very tiny group.
So Will, I want to know more about the OSS education system, because in France, we all go to mostly we go to public schools and it's very Republican and secular, and we don't really differentiate through religion or through cultures or through communities. It's very leveled and everyone has to fit in a standard. So it's difficult to explain, but you have to become French. And other people I talked to made a lot of efforts to fit in and to kind of erase their Asian part. So I don't know how how is it for you in an Australian system?
Yeah, I mean, that's tough to hear because, I'm guessing that there are and there were instances of that where you need to fit in. So, I mean, my earliest, I went to preschool, which was close to where my mom was working, my parents were working. And then when I went to primary school, I was actually baptized because it was a Catholic school. And even though my parents are Buddhist, you know, it was actually quite a common trend to send your kid to a Christian or Catholic school because it was the best option available. And I do think that, you know, set a very interesting standard for immigrant parents, where they do what they can. They send you to do tutoring, you know, 3, 4, 5 times a week so you get the best education so you can have a stable career and stable life. And so there's two types of high schooling systems, private schools and public schools, and of which public schools have a segment for high achievers. Mm-hmm. And to get into this high achiever selective school process, you need to go through, you know, some rigorous examinations. And I was, you know, very fortunate to get into one of the top 10 schools in the state. And when you went to that school, it's the same story over and again. You know, your parents, you know, pushing you to do tutoring. Even in high school, it's tutoring to get to the best university. When you're in university, you do your law, finance, medicine, engineering
that's
degree.
That's the only thing you're allowed to do, right?
And so anything you're allowed to do, like there's plenty of memes that talk about that. But mm-hmm. I do think, I mean, this is why I'm in education now, or my business is in education, because I do think that system was just a way for our parents' generation to push us in the best way they knew how. And so I went through this, I would say, fast-tracked, hardcore tutoring approach where, you know, my parents would even put the tutoring on their credit card or write blank checks to make sure that I'm progressing to the next sort of degree or the next elevation in my educational path. Sometimes I reflect back and it's almost you feel guilty because you don't appreciate it, but then you understand why they were doing that in the first place. So as I mentioned before, Vivian, like my school, I would say 90% were Asian, of which half of them would have been Indian, and then a quarter Korean, Chinese, and then Chinese Vietnamese, and the rest would be Australian. Yeah, and I think that was quite common across a lot of the top, I would say top 20 schools in the state.
When I first heard it, I thought it's an Asian school because you are in an Asian neighborhood, but actually, no, it's because it's a very high standard school, and everyone pushes there.
You talk about neighborhoods, but my family moved 4 to 5 times throughout primary to university, and it was moving from the west to north. And you're actually seeing these immigration patterns where, let's say 10 years ago, the Chinese would have, you know, moved after that, making their money in the city or in groceries or butcheries, they would have bought bigger houses in better locations. And now you have this new immigrant community of people from Thailand, from Vietnam again, from the Middle East, trying to build their own ecosystem and building from the ground up. So it's not just picking the schools because of the academics and the brand, but also the location. My school was in North Sydney, which was in a very prestigious neighborhood. So that exposure, even though you had to take 1.5 hours of transport to get there, you're essentially spending 1.5 hours with other kids that were traveling so far for that school.
So it worked. So you are grateful for your parents that they sacrificed for you? Or
yes, I do it differently. I do it differently now when I end up having kids, but it was the best thing that they knew at that time.
So if you have kids now, you would shift that, right? Because you went through this experience of being pushed as a child.
Well, I think you look at the hierarchy of needs, and you know, our parents, they were striving for security and stability. And so if my dad was a cab driver and my mom was, you know, doing different businesses, what they do was, you know, send the kids to good schools, get good grades, good jobs, and have stability for the rest of their life, which is where most of my friends sit at the moment. But as an entrepreneur, you kind of look at it differently, which is if the next wave of career and opportunities isn't in your, you know, standard corporate jobs, where does that look like? And, you know, in the age of automation and AI, how can you, you know, help your kids or the future generations think more creatively and be more purposeful and be more willing to take that risk? And that's another thing that is super interesting, like doing this project, because, you know, if my grandparents and their siblings took a gamble to buy a boat that fit 70 people across rising tides with pirates chasing them, and we're worried about not getting the good internship at a bank, how does that actually measure, you know, which is more important? So when I think about the future, you know, generation of Asians, it is, the future is Asia. If the, you know, 1800s was the European century, the 1900s were the US century, the next century is Asia. The Asian century. Mm-hmm. So how can you start tying those values, but also bring back that pride? Mm-hmm. And that's why, you know, what you're doing is amazing, because it allows you to have multiple views on Western and Asian worlds, and hopefully be able to capitalize that, not just with community, but with opportunity, with relationships, and just nuances in cultural values.
Yeah, exactly. We want to show the diversity and understand ourselves better. So thank you, Will. I think we covered a lot today. Is there anything you want to add? Or
I think this is a very good starting point. And like I said, I do feel as though people like you and I are actually at the forefront of making this change. So just as similar as me writing this family autobiography or family, you know, family tree digitized version, it is actually on our onus to be able to push these causes forward, because the generation behind us are still figuring things out and the generation above us are not as tech savvy or not as motivated, because they may already have their lives, they already have their roots really deep ingrained into society.
So this is our calling, and we are empowered to do that.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, thank you, Will.
Thanks, Vivian.
Thank you for listening till the end. And if you like this episode, please share it with your friends and give us some good ratings, a lot of stars, and follow us on our Instagram and Facebook accounts, banana.split.project. See you soon.